This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
So this is the Scarlet Letter and the effects of sin confessed and unconfessed. And I don't know how familiar you are with the novel. I've read it, I don't know how many times. I do use the Abeka version in class because we have the Abeka curriculum for high school. So I use this one, and I'm going to be referring to this one. I will mention chapters so that if you're using a different one, you know, your pages aren't going to line up with mine. But I will refer to chapters, and what I have on the screen will be the more likely the chapters instead of the actual page numbers. But I will be going through pretty much through the book. But first of all, I'd like to talk about Sophia just a little bit. Sophia was an artist of her own right and got married and, you know, kind of dropped the artwork and was a faithful wife and mother to her family. And one day her husband came home. He had a job as an official, and he came home and was kind of upset, depressed, worried, because he had just lost his job. And it was not any fault of his own. It was only because the political party had changed, and because of the change in the political party, he no longer had his job. Kind of like the cabinet for the president, you know, when the president changes, new president chooses his own cabinet. Kind of the same kind of thing had happened. And so he came home, he was worried about how he's going to tell Sophia that he doesn't have a job any longer, and what are they going to live on for the next, you know, till he can get another job. He comes home and her response is not at all what he expected. She said, "Now you have time to work on your masterpiece." And he said, "But what will we live on?" And she went to her little stash and pulled it out and said, "Here's enough money for us to live for 2 years. The only thing that's been keeping you from doing your masterpiece is your job. And now you don't have your job." And of course his question was, "Where did you get that?" And she said, "Every time you gave me money for household expenses, I put a little bit aside because I wanted that someday you would have the time to write your masterpiece." And with that, Sophia Peabody's husband, Nathaniel Hawthorne, sat down and wrote Scarlet Letter. So we look at the first part, and I don't know how many of you have kind of skimmed through the Custom House or plagued yourself through the Custom House and then got into the book and said, "What does this have to do with the book?" What's the connection between that 50-page or whatever it is, I think it's 50 pages, introduction to the book titled The Custom House? Well, Nathaniel Hawthorne worked at the Custom House. And if you look at that section of the Custom House, what happens is the official loses his job because of a political change. And the new one comes in, and he starts cleaning out the desk and cleaning up the area around it. And in that, he finds a packet with a story and a scarlet letter. Now, is the Custom House autobiographical? Is it Nathaniel Hawthorne's own story? We don't know. Did he, when he took the job in the Custom House, did he find a packet? Did he find something that kind of got his mind stirring? And the whole time he was working at the Custom House, he is thinking through this story and what could be the story. But he doesn't have time to write it because he's busy at the Customs House. Well, I don't know if they're always busy. The Customs House doesn't seem too terribly busy. But Is he thinking that the whole time he's working at the customs house, but, he doesn't have time to write it because he's working? I don't know. But it almost, there are some things that are kind of like Nathaniel Hawthorne, okay? The official loses his job, a new one comes in. And so maybe it's a bit autobiographical. Maybe it's a bit autobiographical. Should we have our students read that section? A lot of times I would think that if we had our students read that section, to start out with that section, they might get a little bit bogged down and kind of lose interest in the whole novel. And we may have lost it right from the introduction. What I like to do with the introduction is pull out parts of it, not necessarily have them read it, not necessarily have them read the whole thing, but I'll pull out parts of it and say, oh, look, he's describing what it was like in Salem. He's describing how things looked. This is the custom house in Salem, which is where Nathaniel Hawthorne worked. That's the harbor right in front of the customs house. It was right there. And that's the Nathaniel Hawthorne house, which is also just down the road a little bit. Okay. It's not far. So when he walked from the customs house to his house, it wasn't a very far walk to be worried about it. That's just another scene along the, where he would have, at Salem there. There we go. So, I would like to look at just some things in the custom house. And one of the things that I always look at is the very end where the official finds the packet. Okay. Because I think that's the most significant connection to the rest of the novel. Most of the custom house is introduction to the culture, to the society, to what's going on, how people viewed these customs officials. But it's not a clear connection. For the most part, it's not a clear connection to the novel. At least I haven't been able to see the clear connection to the novel. But in the customs house, when he finds it, one idle and rainy day, it was my fortune to make a little discovery of some little interest, poking and burrowing into the heaped up rubbish in the corner, unfolding one and another document, reading the names of vessels that had long ago foundered at sea or rotted at the wharves, and those of merchants never heard of now. I chanced to lay my hand on a small package, carefully done up with a piece of ancient yellow parchment. The envelope had an air of an official record of some period long past, when clerks engrossed their stiff and formal chirography and more substantial materials than at present. There was something about it that quickened an instinctive curiosity and made me undo the faded red tape and tied up the package with a sense of treasure would here be brought to light. And then he unfolds the parchment and he finds a commission from Governor Shirley and a little bit more. And then he says, there were documents, in short, not official, but of a private nature, or at least written in his private capacity and apparently with his own hand. And it describes the object that he finds. But the object that most drew my attention in the mysterious package was a certain affair of fine red cloth, much worn and faded. There were traces about it of gold embroidery, which, however, was greatly frayed and defaced, so that none or very little of the glitter was left. It had been wrought as was easy to perceive, with wonderful skill of needlework. And the stitch, as I am assured by ladies conversant of such mysteries, gives evidence of a now forgotten art. So he places it back, way back in the past. Okay. That this has been hidden in this pile of rubbish for years. Okay. This rag of scarlet cloth for time and wear and a sacrilegious moth had reduced it to little other than a rag. On careful examination, assumed the shape of a letter. It was the capital letter A. That's the package that he finds. And I think our students need to know that little section. They probably need to know something about Hawthorne's picture of society, of the government officials who really have nothing to do. And they're sitting on their chairs on the front porch of the Custom House, kind of leaning back and going over the same old stories over and over and over and over again. Okay. And he spends a lot of time talking about those things. But it kind of sets the culture to where he wants it. Now, there are four characters, and those are the four that we're going to look at most of the time here, is these four, because what I want to look at is the effects of sin, confessed and unconfessed. And we're going to look at Hester, we'll look at Arthur, at Roger, and at Pearl. Now, Hawthorne names his characters intentionally. And if you look at any Hawthorne writing, you're going to find that. You're going to find that the characters are specifically named. He has a reason for the names that he gives them. And all the way through, all the time that I was looking at, every time I taught Scarlet Letter, and I'd look at these characters, well, Arthur Dimmesdale, he's, you know, kind of a dim character. And so the name is significant. Roger Chillingworth, he's a pretty chilling character. And Pearl is Hester's pearl of great price. She pays a lot for Pearl. Okay. But I never had anything with Hester. Well, Hawthorne names characters specifically. So we have Arthur, we have Dimmesdale, we have Chillingworth, and we have Pearl. And then we have Hester. And it wasn't until I was getting ready for this workshop that this thought had never crossed my mind before. Hester. Esther. Born for a time like this. The letters are all there. All he does is take the H out of the middle of Hester and Esther and moves it up to the beginning. That's all he does. That's something to think about. So I haven't thought through it. It just, you know, this summer it came to my mind. But you can think about it. It seems like there must be some reason why it's Hester. And come into a time like this. And maybe that is why he spends so much time in the introduction describing the time, the culture, the Puritan culture. And here she is. And what is society going to do with a woman like this? And what is society going to do with a child like Pearl? So you can think about that. We're going to look at those four, and I was trying to decide how to organize it, and we could go through the novel and look at all four of them as we go, and I decided that's kind of confusing. Maybe let's just look at one character at a time and go through. So we'll kind of go through the book four times. The first time with Hester, and then with Arthur, and then with Roger, and then with Pearl. And look at the sins, and look at the effects of that sin. And for your reference later on, if you want to write these down, these are the chapters that we kind of refer to with each one of the characters. So Hester shows up in chapters 2, 4, 5, 13, 16, and 17. she shows up everywhere, but those are the ones that we see what happens to Hester. What are the effects of her sin? What happens to Hester? And then Arthur, we see him mostly, I mean, the same thing, we pick out certain things that happen to him in chapters 3, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 17, and 23. There are other places, but those are some of the main ones. Roger in chapters 2, 3, 4, 8, 9, 10, 13, 14, and he shows up later, and we're going to look at it later, but those are some of the main chapters. And then Pearl in 3, 5, 6, 8, 15, 16, and 19. And I'll keep that up there for a little bit for you to look at. To copy down if you want those numbers. But we're going to start with Hester. Actually, if I just go to Hester, I have the chapters right at the beginning there. And I think I do for each one of the characters, so as we get to them. So what I want to do is start with Hester, and we'll look just at the first that we see Hester is when she is being brought out to the marketplace, to the scaffold. Hester has no option. She has to confess her sin. I mean, she and her husband sent her to America 2 years before, and now she has this baby. She has to confess her sin. She has no option. But what is she going to do about that? It can't be hidden. She has a child. It can't be hidden. And so everybody knows that, and everyone knows, and in a Puritan society, she is ostracized, she is punished. Okay. And part of that, the first part of that punishment is to be on the scaffold for several hours. And so when we first see her, what I want you to see is her attitude when we first see her. You would think, I mean, here she is with this baby being taken to the scaffold for public humiliation. Okay. But this is how it's described. Stretching forth the official staff in his left hand, he laid his right hand upon the shoulder of a young woman whom he thus drew forward until on the threshold of the prison door, she repelled him by an action marked with natural dignity and force of character. Okay. She's not humiliated. She's a strong character. And she is a strong character all the way through. And then we're introduced to the letter A that she has. Roger comes in because he's recognized as a doctor, and the baby is sick, it's crying, and so he comes in, and tells Hester to also drink some of this medicine that he has. He says, drink it. It may be less soothing than a sinless conscience. Now, if you know the story, who's Roger? You remember? Roger is actually her husband. And he had sent her off to America 2 years before. He arrives with some Indians to the outskirt of the marketplace as she is going up to the scaffold. And he recognizes her. And she recognizes him. Because he's distinctive. In his appearance, he's kind of crooked. Like he's one shoulder is higher than the other. And he just motions her to not recognize him, to not have any, to show any recognition, recognition of him. And she doesn't. She keeps his secret that he is actually her husband. But then they call him in because this baby needs some help. I mean, everybody's getting tired of hearing the baby cry, you know. So they bring him in. He's a doctor. Bring him in. And he gives the baby something. And he says, drink it. He wants to give Hester some, too. He says, drink it. It may be less soothing than a sinless conscience. It's not going to help you as much as a clear conscience would, but it might help you. And he says, that I cannot give thee. I can't give you a clear conscience. But it will calm the swell and heaving of thy passion like oil thrown on the waves of a tempestuous sea. She doesn't quite trust him. And at the end, two paragraphs down, she says, I have thought of death. I have thought of death. Have wished for it, would even have prayed for it, were it fit for such as I should pray for anything. Yet if death be in this cup, I bid thee think again, ere thou beholdst me quaff it. She's afraid he's going to poison her. Okay. But she says, I've thought of death. Thought of dying and just ending this. But think again if there's death in the cup. Okay. Not necessarily a sign of repentance, is it? Maybe wanting to get out of the situation, but not of repentance. And then Roger says, one thing, thou that wast my wife, I would enjoin upon thee. Thou hast kept the secret of thy paramour, the father of your child. Keep likewise mine. Don't tell anyone who I am. Don't let anyone know that I am your husband. Okay. And she promises that just as she has kept the father's identity a secret, she will not tell anyone that Roger is her husband. She recognizes that she and Arthur, who is the father of the child, will come to judgment. And she says, there dwelt the feet of one with whom she deemed herself connected in a union that unrecognized on earth would bring them together before the bar of final judgment and make that their marriage altar for a joint fortuity of endless retribution. There's retribution, but there's not repentance and forgiveness anywhere in Hester. So she recognizes that she and Arthur will come to judgment for their wrong. She hopes that her punishment, here she said to herself, had been the scene of her guilt, and here should be the scene of her earthly punishment. The torture of her daily shame would at length purge her soul and work out another purity than that which she had lost, more saint-like, because the result of martyrdom. So her punishment is what's going to bring her a clear conscience. That's what Hester says. Her punishment is going to bring her a purity that she has lost. Punishment doesn't bring a clear conscience. It may be necessary. I'm not saying no one needs punishment, but I mean discipline. But it's not the forgiveness for her sin. And she refers to it as martyrdom. Is she a martyr? Retribution is a paying back, a kind of martyrdom, maybe,
poetic justice, maybe. But it's not forgiveness for her sin. That can only come from repentance. And when you deal with this with the students, help them, try to help them to see that. That in our society today, punishment is not going to bring a clear conscience. It has to be repentance that brings forgiveness. And Hester doesn't have that. We'll see some more things. So she takes up sewing for the community. Well, she's good. She decorated that letter A, elaborate embroidery, which in itself is probably a sign of not of her pride. Okay. The emblem that is supposed to be her shame, representative of her shame, she has highly decorated. It's an ornament. It's not an emblem of shame. It becomes an ornament. So she's sewing for the community, and we see her sewing everything except they will ask her to sew anything except one thing. But it is not recorded that in a single instance her skill was called in aid to embroider the white veil which was to cover the pure blushes of a bride. How could you get someone like Hester? There must be something wrong with the veil if a woman like Hester does it. She's an evil woman. And then we are going to, well, maybe that's superstition, I don't know. But we're going to skip pretty far to the second half of the book, which Hester shows up in between there, but she's identified later on as, so at the beginning, the women in the community thought that the council was too lenient with her. They were too easy on her to make her wear this letter and stand on the scaffold for 3 hours. That's just too easy. They would have had her killed. Okay, when you look at the marketplace and the conversation that's going on in the marketplace. But as you go through the novel, their attitude toward her changes. As we work through it, the attitude is changing. And by the time we get to this point, which is in chapter 13. Oh, I've been forgetting to tell you which chapters I'm in. Chapter 13, she has become a sister of mercy. Self-appointed. Or we may say the world's heavy hand had so ordained her as a sister of mercy. That many people refused to interpret the scarlet A by its original signification. They said that it meant able. So their perception of her has changed. But it's not because she has repented. But it has changed. She's still ostracized. She's still ostracized, but
She's useful.
It's practical. She's good at what she does. And they like her work. Yeah. Also in chapter 13, everything was against her. The world was hostile. The child's own nature had something wrong in it. And we'll look at Pearl later on, which continually betokened that she had been born amiss. And so often Hester was impelled to ask in bitterness of heart whether it were for ill or for good that the poor little creature had been born at all. She has inner turmoil because of what has happened, but she hasn't come to repentance anywhere. Everything was against her. Again, we have a bit of thinking about death. Way back at the beginning, she said, I've thought of death. This is when Pearl was a baby, just an infant. Also in chapter 13, she says, at times a fearful doubt strove to possess her soul, whether it were not better to send Pearl at once to heaven and go herself to such futurity as eternal justice should provide. So what is she thinking? Maybe it would be better to just kill Pearl now. She would go to heaven and kill myself and let God deal with me wherever he sends me. Okay, so again, we have this reference to suicide, but it's also killing the child now. It's a murder-suicide now that she's thought about. We go to chapter 16, and Hester meets Arthur in the forest. And I'm not going to go into this, but it's significant that it's in the forest. They are really wandering around in kind of a forest, a moral forest. So she plans to meet him. She knows he's going to be coming through the forest. And so she goes out into the forest to meet him when he comes back from where he was. He had gone to see Apostle Eliot, who was a missionary to the Indians, and that's historically accurate. So Hawthorne does pick up some actual things that did happen and put them in there. There was the Apostle Eliot, who was a missionary to the Indians. And as they meet, and Pearl says, but you may sit down if you will tell me a story meanwhile. A story, child, said Hester, about what? Oh, a story about the black man. Who's the black man? Anytime you see the black man capitalized in literature, particularly coming from the Puritan or early national time period. Who's the black man referring to? It's referring to Satan. Okay. When it's the black man, capital letters, capital B, capital M. It's referring to Satan.
Does that have racist overtones?
I don't know if it does. I think it's more because and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but by the end of the novel, they're referring to Roger Chillingworth as the black man and describing him as being darker and darker and darker, and that he's sooty from the infernal furnace. So maybe it's more that than it is racist. It could be racist, but I don't. I mean, 21st century people would jump on racism right away. I'm not sure that it was for Hawthorne. And you see that in a number of pieces of literature that the black man refers to. Tom Walker, the devil in Tom Walker. It's the black man. There are others, yeah. And Pearl says, tell me a story about the black man. What does Pearl know about the black man? Well, she keeps on going. Pearl keeps on going and says how he haunts this forest and carries a book with him. If you didn't know who the black man is, you know, this paragraph kind of explains how he haunts the forest and carries a book with him, a big, heavy book with iron clasps, and how this ugly black man offers his book and an iron pen to everybody that meets him here among the trees, and they are to write their names with their own blood. And then he sets his mark, and this is significant, and then he sets his mark on their bosoms. Didst thou ever meet the black man, mother? What does she see immediately about Hester? Even as an infant, she reaches for Hester's scarlet letter. Where does the black man set his mark? On the bosom, right where Hester's scarlet letter is. And so Pearl says, did you ever meet the black man? And Hester says, who told you that story? Who told you that? You know, sometimes you wonder where children hear things that they hear. Who told you that story? And Pearl says, it was the old dame in the chimney corner at the house where you watched last night, old Mistress Hibbins. The old dame said that this scarlet letter was the black man's mark on thee, and that it glows like a red flame when thou meetest him at midnight here in the dark wood. Hester just asked her, did you ever wake up at night and find that I wasn't there? She doesn't say, no, I've never met the black man. But did you ever wake up and I wasn't there? And then finally, just the next page, once in my life I met the black man. The scarlet letter is his mark. Let me go to chapter 17. And we have Hester and Arthur again. It's a little bit later. But they are both comparing their marks. And Arthur asks Hester, hast thou found peace? And her answer to him is, hast thou? She answers with another question. Have you found peace? And he says, Hester, I am most miserable. I am most miserable. More misery, Hester, only the more misery. The contrast between what I seem and what I am. Is there no reality in the penitence thus sealed and witnessed by good works? It's kind of jumping to Arthur, but doing good is going to give him a clear conscience. Does it? Oh, I've done this terrible thing, I'm just going to do a lot of good things. Yeah. And Arthur says, of penance I've had enough. Of penitence there has been none. Hester, that wear the... back up just a little bit. Happy are you, Hester, that wear the scarlet letter openly upon your bosom. Mine burns in secret. Mine burns in secret. And finally, also in chapter 17, Hester, she's got permission to do this, but Hester finally tells Arthur who Roger actually is. She says, forgive me, O Arthur, forgive me, and all things else I have striven to be true. Truth was the one virtue which I might have held fast, the one thing I did that was right. Then I consented to a deception, but a lie is never good. even when death threatened on the other side. Dost thou not see what I say, what I would say? That old man, the physician, he whom they call Roger Chillingworth, he was my husband. And so she finally says who it is, who Roger actually is. And Arthur says he can never forgive her. But then he says, the old man's... Yeah. That old man's revenge has been blacker than my sin. He has violated in cold blood the sanctity of the human heart. And so, yes, I've done wrong, but Roger's worse than I am. Roger's sin is worse than mine. Does that sound like things that we hear in society today? Yeah. And to me, that's one of the things that we need to help students to see, is that it is an old novel, and it's set even before the time that it was written. But human nature is the same. And some of these things are exactly the same as what we have now. A clear sign, chapter 17, a clear sign that Hester is not repentant of her sin is that she and Arthur plan to book passage on the ship that's at port. And what they plan to do is leave, go back to the old world together with Pearl. Pearl, Arthur, and Hester. Go back to the old world and start over. And no one will ever know that it's not a husband and a wife. They're family. They just won't go where Hester lived before. If she's repentant, she's not going to do something like that. She's going to leave Roger here in America, go back to the old world, and start all over with Arthur. And they can put all of this behind them because nobody will know it. Does that work? You're taking your conscience along, right? Yeah. Well, Hester's probably the one I spend the most time on. So let's go to Arthur. There's Arthur, dim character. Arthur is weak right from the very beginning. I'm going to go back to chapter 3. Oh, I got a wrong page number there somewhere, because page 23 is not in chapter 3. First when we meet Arthur is when Hester is on the scaffold. And Mr. Wilson tells him that he has the responsibility of this woman's soul. It is chapter 3. This is Mr. Wilson, the older man, says, "Good Master Dimmesdale," said he, "the responsibility of this woman's soul lies greatly with you. It behooves you, therefore, to exhort her to repentance and to confession and a proof and consequence thereof." And Arthur says, "Hester Prynne," said he, leaning over the balcony and looking down steadfastly into her eyes, "thou hearest what this good man says and seest the accountability under which I labor. If thou feelest it to be for thy soul's peace and that thy earthly punishment will thereby be made more effectual to salvation, I charge thee to speak out the name of thy fellow sinner and fellow sufferer." Mm-hmm. Be not silent from any mistaken pity and tenderness for him. For believe me, Hester, though he were to step down from a high place and stand there beside thee on thy pedestal of shame, yet better were it so than to hide a guilty heart through life. Where is Arthur when he says that? Up on the balcony. He leans over the balcony to speak to her. Though he were to come down from a high place, literally from a high place, but Arthur's position in the community is a high position. He's the minister in the community. And for him to come down to that scaffold, he's coming down from pretty high in the community. Hester will not say the name of the father. And at the end, Arthur says, wondrous strength and generosity of a woman's heart, she will not speak. Whew. Why does Hester not say who the father is? Why won't she say that? And this is a good thing to point out to your students.
It's
his job to bring his own sin to the front. He needs to confess, and she will not confess for him. She will not confess for him. He needs to confess. And she is calling him to that position, to that point of confessing. I'm not going to say. You need to do it yourself. And he's a weak character. He can't do it. He tries. Throughout the novel, he's preaching a sermon. And he keeps telling his congregation how awful he is and how sinful he is. But every time he does it, their view of him just gets higher. And he can't come out and directly say what it is. Well, as we go through the novel, starting chapter 8, they're deciding if this is one good point that Arthur does in chapter 8. The officials are trying to decide if Hester should actually keep Pearl or not, or if they should take her from her. And she appeals to Arthur. She appeals directly to Arthur. And the young minister at once came forward, pale and holding his hand over his heart. He looked now more careworn and emaciated. So what's happening to him? As you go through the novel, he becomes weaker and weaker, more frail, more fragile, physically. And then he says at the end, truth in what Hester says and in the feeling which inspires her, God gave her the child and gave her to an instinctive knowledge of its nature and requirements. And so he says that she has the right to keep her. Okay. It's one time when he does stand up and say something against what the others are saying. One time when he has a little bit of strength. The health of Dimmesdale keeps failing. Again, chapter 8. The health of Mr. Dimmesdale had evidently begun to fail. He has fasts and vigils, of which he made a frequent practice. What he does in those vigils, we're not told. There are some hints, but we're not really told. Chapter 9, the young minister, he says, I need no medicine, but how could the young minister say so when with every successive Sabbath his cheek was paler and thinner and his voice more tremulous than before? And the habit of putting his hand over his heart. Let's go to chapter 10. His health had been failing. He had now had Roger as his doctor, and Roger lives with him so that he can give him constant care. Well, Arthur goes to sleep, and Roger kind of sneaks in. He stirred not in his chair when old Roger Chillingworth, without any extraordinary precaution, came into the room. The physician advanced directly in front of his patient, laid his hand upon his bosom, and thrust aside the vestment that hitherto had always covered it, even from the professional eye. And with what a wild look of wonder, joy, and horror. Manifest by the extravagant gestures with which he threw up his arms toward the ceiling and stamped his foot upon the floor at the moment of his ecstasy. He makes a discovery by opening Arthur's vesture. Let's go to chapter 11. What did he see? Arthur's parishioners viewed him too holy to walk on earth. He says he is the worst of sinners. He's an abomination. And they view him as too holy to walk on earth. The difference between what I am and what I seem to be. The next page in, and this is where we have the hint of what Roger may have seen. In Mr. Dimmesdale's secret closet under lock and key was a bloody scourge. He tortured, but could not purify himself. Which is why he always has his hand over his heart. He wants to confess to his congregation. Doesn't do it. Chapter 12, he goes to the scaffold at night where Hester had stood years before and holds a vigil there. Mr. Dimmesdale was overcome with a great horror of mind, as if the universe were gazing at a scarlet token on his naked breast right over his heart. He shrieks and he thinks that everybody has heard him. The whole town has heard him, and they're all going to come out here and find him here on the scaffold in the morning. He knows he should have been where Hester was. He should have been there when Hester was there. He knows that. Chapter 12, we are at the middle of the novel, and we kind of get to a turning point. Or, I don't know if it's a turning point, but right at this point, right in the middle of the book, is where he's on the scaffold and Hester is coming home from delivering something and has Pearl with her. And they find Arthur on the scaffold and they stop and he takes their hands and he's there on the on the scaffold. The three formed an electric chain. Minister, whispered little Pearl, Wilt thou stand here with mother and me tomorrow noontide? You'll stand here with us at night, but will you stand here with us at noontide? So even Pearl is calling him to confess him. Well, he finally does confess. Chapter 17, Arthur begs Hester to be strong for him. Chapter 23, we get to the end of the novel, and he does confess, finally. He does confess. He had come opposite the well-remembered and weather-darkened scaffold where long since the dreary lapse of time between Hester Prynne had entered the world's ignominious there. The crowd, meanwhile, looked on in awe and wonder. He turned toward the scaffold and stretched out his arms. Hester, said he, come hither, come my little Pearl. And And he does confess and dies. Okay. Let's go to Roger. Roger's sin is not adultery like it is for Hester and Arthur. Roger's sin is the seeking of revenge. The first time we see Roger is back there at the beginning when he's with Hester. Well, actually, the first time we see him is in Hester's memories. She's thinking about him. He's well stricken in years. He's pale. He's thin. He's scholar-like. And he has eyes that could read the human soul. It's in chapter 2. Chapter 3, we find that his one shoulder is higher than the other. I say a bit of a distinctive appearance. He's misshapen physically at the beginning. Also in chapter 3, Roger declares that Hester's partner will be discovered. He says he will be known. He will be known. And he makes that his driving force all the way through the novel. He knows long before the end of the novel. He knows before he moves in with Arthur. I've got him. I know who it is. I know who it is. And then he just wants to torture him the rest of the way through the book. Okay. That's his sin. Chapter 4, Roger admits his part in the blame for what happened. He says, "It was my folly and thy weakness. I should have never sent you off by yourself 2 years before I came." So he recognizes his, he's got a part in this. And he recognizes that. He confesses it to Hester. He asks her again in private, chapter 4. He asks her again in private for the father's name. She won't give it. She says, "I will keep his secret just as I'm keeping yours." And he says, "Few things are hidden from the man who devotes himself earnestly and unreservedly to the solution of a mystery." If I set myself to it, I'm going to find out. Chapter 8, Roger suggests who the father is. They're there with the officials, and he says, "Well, it's easy to see the mother's part in her. But don't you think, gentlemen, that to analyze the child's nature and from it, its make and mold, to give a shrewd guess at the father?" Speaking to the other officials, the older minister, and to the government officials, "Don't you think, just look at her. She looks kind of like her mother, okay? You can easily see her mother in her. But look at her nature and look at her. Don't you think we could make a guess at who the father is?" He knows by chapter 8. He knows who it is. Chapter 9, Roger's aspect has undergone a change since he's dwelt in town. Here's 144. I'm running out of time. I knew this would happen, but. There was something ugly and evil in his face. Something ugly and evil in his face. According to the vulgar idea, which vulgar doesn't, vulgar would be in the sense of being common, the fire in his laboratory had been brought from the lower regions. The fire in his laboratory had been brought from hell, from the lower regions, and was fed with infernal fuel. And so, as might be expected, his visage was getting sooty with the smoke. Chapter 13. Hester thinks that she had climbed her way since then to a higher point. The old man, on the other hand, Roger, on the other hand, had brought himself nearer to her level, or perhaps below it, by the revenge which he had stooped for. It's chapter 13. Chapter 14, Roger says he pities Hester, and Hester responds with, "And I thee, I pity you, for the hatred that has transformed a wise and just man to a fiend." I have 30 seconds for Pearl. Okay. Pearl's caught in the effects of a sinful world. And we don't have any record of sin as such in Pearl's life. Okay. But she's the product of the adultery. First time we see Pearl, she is the embodiment of that scarlet letter, while Hester wears drab clothing. But Pearl is always dressed in scarlet and gold, just like the scarlet letter. Chapter 6, Pearl is described as a being whose elements were perhaps beautiful and brilliant, but all in disorder, with an order peculiar to themselves. Hester, because of her own guilt, could not discipline Pearl. What right do I have to discipline her? Look at what I've done. I know a single mother who cannot discipline her child. And I often wonder if it's this. She says, the only thing I've known of discipline was abuse. But might there be some of this? I think we see it in our society. Pearl was an outcast. If children gathered around her, as they did sometimes, Pearl would grow positively terrible in her puny wrath, snatching up stones to fling at them with shrill, incoherent exclamations that made her mother tremble, because they had so much the sound of a witch's anathemas in some unknown tongue. Hawthorne keeps putting little hints in here that Pearl is demon-possessed. One of the things that I have my students do sometimes is to decide, is, why did I even bring a PowerPoint? I'm not even doing it. Is to decide and to research through the novel, do their book review on that, is Pearl demon-possessed? And you can argue from the book on both sides. Because Hawthorne sticks enough of things in, connections to witches and all kinds of stuff like that. He keeps sticking stuff in like that. But is she? Or is she just a child like many children in our society that are not disciplined and feel the ostracism of society, and she's trying to gain some kind of control or order or something? Okay. Not secure. She throws temper tantrums.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.